Wednesday, April 1st, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McAuliffe comes to the MU campus to talk to law school students and faculty, but the media and the public weren't allowed in. We'll talk about what happened at Holston Hall. A project from the Colorado Springs Gazette claims to clear the haze, looking at the effects of that state's legalization of marijuana a year later. But did the paper go far enough to let its readers know that this product was of its editorial board and not its newsroom? And we'll look at how cultural differences played out in the coverage of the German Wings plane crash here in America. No one batted an eyelash at naming the co-pilot who took down that plane, while in France and Germany, there was some outrage. There's a whole lot more that we're going to try to get to and pack into this half hour. But first, I don't know, it's been what, about a month or 6 weeks since we talked about some of the crazy changes in the state of Indiana? Well, it's about all anyone's talking about again now that Governor Mike Pence signed the state's Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law. It makes it possible for businesses to refuse service based on a person's, quote, exercise of religion. People who support it say it protects religious freedom from religion, but those who don't say it legalizes discrimination, especially against LGBTQ individuals. ABC's George Stephanopoulos asked Pence about it on This Week this past Sunday morning.
Sir, I'm just bringing up a message from one of your supporters. That was one of your supporters who was talking about the bill right there. It said it would protect a Christian florist who against any kind of punishment. Is that true or not?
George, look, the issue here is, you know, is tolerance a two-way street or not? I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk about tolerance in this country today having to do with people on the left. But here Indiana steps forward to protect the constitutional rights and privileges of freedom of religion for people of faith and families of faith in our state. And this avalanche of intolerance that's been poured on our state is just outrageous.
So Stephanopoulos tried maybe 6-7 times to get a straight answer to that question in an interview that went almost 12 minutes. He never really got it. Since that time Sunday morning, several cities and states have called for travel bans to Indiana. The NCAA Final Four starts in Indianapolis coming up. What do we think is going to end up happening?
Well, I think something's definitely going to happen this week because yesterday Pence asked the legislature to send him, I guess, an addendum to the law, basically saying that this law does not discriminate against gay and lesbian couples. So, you know, right now, I think that the economic backlash that Indiana is facing has caused them to rethink whether or not they really want to do this. And now they're trying to put a Band-Aid on it. Meanwhile, Arkansas has passed a bill. It's going to be signed into law. Then they're going to face the same thing.
Although, in fact, breaking Walmart news, this morning said, Governor Hutchison in Arkansas said he's not signing that bill.
So the economics have gotten to him now.
Well, there was a lot of pressure from Walmart on that. In that news conference, Ernest, that you had mentioned that Mike Pence held yesterday, he blamed the media in a lot of regards, claiming that we hadn't done a good enough job, that the nuances of this bill now turned law weren't really well explained. I kind of take issue with that. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that the predominant narrative of the media coverage has been with the concern about whether or not there would be discrimination if this law went into effect. I think he tried to explain, and certainly the media gave him time on the air and in print to say that he thought that it wasn't about discrimination. But I think the primary narrative was that this is the likely outcome of the bill.
And I think part of the issue here is that the fact that those who wrote the bill specifically said that this bill was to give cover to those who did not want to provide services to same-sex couples. And when they came out and said that, that pretty much became the narrative. So to be able to try to backtrack on that without changing the law, it just makes no sense.
I think there was a very interesting take that some in the media, including the Indianapolis Star, pointed out, and that's that it's true that the state could decide that it would trump that law and say you cannot discriminate against somebody, but the anti-discrimination laws in most of the states where this current law, this religious freedom law exists, does not cover people on sexual orientation, including in Indiana and including in Missouri, where we also have a freedom of religion bill or law in place. Mm-hmm. There are some states like Illinois that have both the freedom of religion bill and protections against
discrimination.
And if that's the case, then probably Pence would be right. I doubt that Pence is going to push for a law that would call for no discrimination against people based on their sexual orientation.
The thing about it is, and this is what's really coming out, is that you have the beginning of the culture war 2016 mm-hmm. in relation to the upcoming presidential election. And you're going to have Republicans who are going to have to take a stand on these things. And if these laws can be placed in certain states that meet the criteria that Mike just stipulated, then they're going to have to come out either saying yes, they're for it, or yes, they're against it. And that puts them in a box, which, as we all know, was the same thing that happened to Romney. He got placed in a box. And then when you get the nomination and you go national, it becomes a crutch, or it can become a crutch.
And when these state governors are trying to say or use the federal government as cover, they point out, well, a law was passed in 1993 and President Bill Clinton signed it with language very much like this. 1993 was a very different place when it comes to protecting people's rights through to sexual orientation than it is now.
Okay. Last night, the student chapter of the Missouri Association of Prosecuting Attorneys welcomed St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McAuliffe to campus and lecture about grand juries. You probably remember McAuliffe's name. He's drawn criticism for his handling of the grand jury that decided not to indict former Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson for shooting Michael Brown last August. Given what we've seen in the past few months, you'd expect an event like this to draw a large audience, significant press coverage, protests, etc. Well, not so much, because the organizers closed off the event. It was offered for law school students and faculty only. Those folks even had to register in order to get in. The media, including two reporters from KBIA, was told that a live feed would be available in an overflow room, but during the event, technical difficulties prevented that from happening. KBIA reporters got their link via email to that video around 8:15, 8:30 this morning. Reading accounts of this in the Tribune, talking to the KBIA reporters myself this morning, this has turned into quite a mess.
Yeah, and the problem here is that, okay, it's fine that you didn't have enough room in there for everyone to come in. That's your story and you're sticking to it. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that you didn't allow the media to come in. I have a real problem with that, because you know the significance, or at least the people at the law school put this together should have known the significance of bringing him to campus, and to not have some sort of media availability either during or before really causes a problem. You knew there were going to be protesters. You knew that some people are going to say, you know, you're doing this in a public place, at
which
a place that is financed
than,
by taxpayers.
Which would be very different than if it was this organization, a professional chapter of the organization, holding a luncheon somewhere. Say.
Exactly. So, I mean, when you do that, you sort of open yourself up to this kind of criticism, and you can make all the excuses in the world, but nothing's going to get past the point that you brought this a controversial figure on the campus and you close it off, and it lacks transparency, and now you're going to have to answer questions about it.
I mean, do they have the right to invite a speaker to come in and speak only to their folks? Of course
they do.
The optics of it are terrible. And, you know, I mean, they didn't have enough room. Well, there are lots of places on campus where you could have held a public event that would have held as many people as wanted to show up, if that was your intent, to have as broad a conversation as possible. On the other hand, I can understand folks from the law school feeling, you know, what this will turn into if we make it a public event. It will not be a reasoned conversation about McCullough and his actions with the grand jury in the Ferguson case. There would have been protesters. There would have been people shouting down McCullough and anybody else who tried to ask an intelligent question. It probably would have devolved into just exactly the kind of media circus that, you know, they were trying to avoid. It doesn't mean they shouldn't have tried to include the media, but I can imagine what it would have been like if it had been thrown wide open.
And that's the point I'm making here. I understand the reasoning behind the fact they didn't want to open it up to the public for all the things that you just mentioned. But to not have some sort of presence there of the media creates an even more lack of transparency.
And if you're going to claim space is an issue, when that technical difficulty came up that prevented the live video feed, there were, as I'm told, close to a dozen different members of the media from several different outlets in the market. Have them elect a pool reporter and let one person in if there isn't enough space for all 10 or 12 of them, so that there's some kind of reporter, some journalistic presence to record, report, and document what went on in the meeting.
So what I would really like to know, and hasn't been reported yet, what, if any, stipulations or conditions did McCullough place on his appearing here? If he was the one that said, oh, we can only have a few people by invitation and we're not going to promote it except over spring break within the law school, that's one thing. If the law school set those conditions without McCullough asking for them, that'd be another.
Well, KBIA reporter Kara Tabor and Michaela Tucker told me that they contacted and spoke with folks in the MU News Bureau before going to ensure that they would have access. So that was something that was asked about in any kind of questions about limiting media involvement or media access were addressed at least by reporters at KBIA prior to even showing up at the event. So if that kind of an agreement was made prior to the event, that didn't get carried out to the PR people who were trying
to. But even when they began, they understood or realized that they were having technical difficulties with the feed. They should have opened the doors and allowed several reporters in there to be able to record.
Or at the very least, like I said, one and create a pool report that could somehow happen too. Think back to some of the most shocking stories that get covered, the kinds with mass casualties. We've covered them in our time on 9/11. We wanted to know who took down those planes. We wanted to know who shot up Sandy Hook and Columbine High School. We wanted to know who took down the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. Names like Muhammad Atta and Adam Lanza, Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold, and Timothy McVeigh live on in our memories. So it shouldn't have been much of a surprise. It didn't take long for the media to report 29-year-old Andrea Lubitz was the co-pilot who intentionally crashed German Wings Flight 9525, killing 150 or so on board. Here in the U.S., that's how we do things. But in Europe, it's different. In Germany and in France, there's been outrage that the American media named Lubitz and potentially put his family at risk for retribution.
The house where Andreas Lubitz's parents live in the German town of Montabaur, shuttered and guarded by police. Men, perhaps investigators, the only ones granted access.
Und kannten Sie den Herr Lubitz?
We were told the grandparents lived in this nearby house, but they're unwilling to speak about the man French prosecutors say may have deliberately crashed Flight 9525. I ask if they're relatives. No, thank God, we're not, they say, getting into a police car. We're just trying to get away.
Just trying to get away. Let's talk about this. There's an American sentimentality. We kind of feel we have this need to know. We need to have a face or somebody that we can, for lack of a better way of expressing it, pin some of these horrible, horrible things on.
Well,
a face to put on it.
Try to understand why, whether we'll ever really know, we have to delve into the person and we need to name the person. At least that would be our perspective. And by the way, I'll say it's true that a lot of people in Europe and in Germany especially reacted negatively to it. But it wasn't just to American coverage. German media named him fairly quickly. And I think they were probably right to do so. But they had to issue all sorts of defenses to try to calm down their readership, something we would never have had to do.
I think the issue here is that for the information to come out so quickly, which is not the usual way that this happens, sort of caught the media, I think our media and other media off guard, and they got the name and realized that it was an intentional thing, and they ran with it. It is a global media now, and yes, American media does have a huge influence on what's going on, but I think Mike is right in terms of it wasn't just American media, it was also the European media that also released the names, and they're dealing with the backlash because their citizenry, their audience is not used to that kind of openness and sort of, you know, spur of the moment, we got the information, we're going to run with the type of journalism that I think the American audiences are used to.
There are cultural differences. And if you look in Germany, for example, which has been reunified after years under communist rule in East Germany, people were being spied on by their government all the time. And so there's a much more of a sensitivity to privacy than there is here. And, you know, you've got the same thing you see in the whole debate about Google and whether people can wipe clean their records on Google.
Right,
it's
to be forgotten.
It's the EU that is pushing for that, not anybody in the United States. And it is based on real cultural sensitivities in those countries that we don't really understand all that.
And I think that they're not used to the fact that you have sort of this media pack that's outside of people's homes and that sort of thing. We've become used to that here. And when they see that over there, they're sort of like, whoa, wait a minute, that's not the way we do things.
Ernest, you're teeing me up again. I love when you do that. That sense of that pack, that sense of people right away finding out who is involved in a story. It's something that's evolved over the last 20 years or so. It, you know, cyberbullying, reporting online 20 years ago wasn't a thing. And Monica Lewinsky has a lot to say about that. She says she was patient zero, becoming that woman almost overnight when word of her affair with Bill Clinton was reported in 1998.
Cruelty to others is nothing new. But online, technologically enhanced shaming is amplified, uncontained, and permanently accessible. The echo of embarrassment used to extend only as far as your family, village, school, or community. But now it's the online community too. Millions of people, often anonymously, can stab you with their words, and that's a lot of pain. And there are no perimeters around how many people can publicly observe you and put you in a public stockade. There is a very personal price to public humiliation. And the growth of the internet has jacked up that price.
So we were off last week, but Mike, you told me you still had some things you wanted to say about this and to bring it back to the table and talk about it.
Well, first of all, I watched her entire TED Talk, and I would encourage our audience to do likewise if you haven't. I mean, it really does bring home the message of just how important it is to think about not only what happened to her, but what's happening now because of social media to any number of young women. And frankly, the thing that I took from it more than anything else was just how much responsibility the media had 17 years ago and still has to try to, you know, draw back from what was said about her. I mean, she was called some of the most horrible things in the media, and not just by pundits, but by journalists. I mean, called a little tart or the portly pepper pot or a bimbo or that woman, all those things.
Well, and that woman she was called
well,
by
Bill
the
Clinton
president
called her
of the United States.
But the point of it is that I think for a long time, we didn't feel any disinclination to attack her. I mean, we found all kinds of rationales for saying, well, she was being used by Republican operatives against a president. Feminists weren't defending her. Now we have some feminists and some media people coming out and saying, I feel kind of sorry for what we did. That's really nice 17 years later that you can finally feel sorry for it. But at the very least, we ought to shine a light on the issue that she's shining a light on. And that's the fact that today, the media, traditional and otherwise, have some responsibility when it comes to this slut shaming and cyberbullying and a lot of the problems that she's trying to address.
Yeah, what I'm concerned about is whether or not the media actually learned from what they did 17 years ago, because we still see a lot of that today, especially when it comes to our entertainment news. We talk about that on this show a lot, about some of the things that the so-called infotainment or entertainment media do in terms of sort of slut shaming certain celebrities and going after someone who may have said something off the cuff. And it's not just on television, it's social media, it's on various other parts of our media. So I still don't think that we've learned the lessons from the Lewinsky scandal.
Ironically enough, while I was watching the TED Talk in preparation for today's show last Thursday, I got a tweet from my dad about a conversation on Twitter between two sports talk radio personalities. Matt Spiegel and Dan Bernstein are the hosts on the CBS-owned station The Score in Chicago. Wednesday night, Spiegel tweeted about watching Comcast Sportsnet sideline reporter Ayanna Kristal's stilted on-air delivery, and Bernstein replied with a rather crass comment about her body. And their back and forth went on for more than 20 minutes on Twitter, focusing on her body, not her work. As you can imagine, social media blew up, and I was one of those screaming from the top of my cyber lungs, something that both of you know I don't do often. As a former WSCR intern and one-time wannabe sports reporter, I'm outraged that in 2015 this is still happening and women are seen as sex objects before we're seen as journalists. Both men went on the air the day after and apologized. You can listen to their full apologies on the Links blog if you're so inclined. But I have to say, while Dan Bernstein and Matt Spiegel are responsible, in my opinion at least, for the words that they said, the things they said, maybe they're not the only ones to blame here, that the culture of sports talk radio has a lot too.
Yes, I mean, we've talked about that on the show as well, is that, you know, in sports, they tend to think that they can get away with some of these things, but that's not happening anymore. You can put it, if you put it on your blog, if you tweet about it, if you say it on the air, you're going to get called out because it's going to travel throughout the internet, blogosphere, or whatever you want to call it. And when it gets out there, you're going to have people attack you, and then you're going to have to deal with it. And I tell my students all the time, it's not what you meant to do, because that's what they say in apologies. It's what you did. And that's what sticks with you. And until their employers start dealing with them in a much harsher way, you're going to continue to see some of this.
See, and I think, and I realize, Mike, one second, I think one of the things we need to talk about here, though, is the role that the employers play. I went and I did some research to see what the makeups of the staff is at some of these stations. And at WSCR, if you take a look at the editorial employees who are bylined, there are 22 people who are either identified as on-air hosts, reporters, or bloggers online. In that group, there are 22 people. 20 of them are white males. 2 of them are males of color, or persons of color. That's going to help breed some of these attitudes and thinking about how you treat other people.
Yeah. Well, and who knows what may ultimately happen, but the station hasn't taken any disciplinary action against either one of them. I will give, you say it that way. I was going to say give him credit. I'm not giving him credit, but at least Bernstein made a real apology. We talk about the kinds of apologies that people normally make when they're caught in situations like this. I mean, at least he said, I was stupid. I own it. I wish I had a second thought about sending it. I mean, he gave about as full-throated an apology publicly as one might give. But I want to bring it back to this notion of, you know, who's ultimately responsible. And I get a little bit pessimistic when I look at the fact that as you've heard me say many, many times, with the social media fueled culture we have today, are you going to get rid of the trolls? Are you going to get rid of people saying stupid stuff online? Maybe not. But pull it back to Monica Lewinsky for a second and look at how now young women are coming out and supporting her when they didn't before. Maybe because they know with their experience with social media and how everything about their private life is recorded forever, maybe they're a little bit more sensitive and maybe they will help us do something about it.
And that's a generational change. I mean, I was in college when the Monica Lewinsky story broke, so I'm actually just a couple of years younger than she is. The people who are now our age, or the people who are currently the age that we were at that time, have been the digital natives raised in this social media environment. I do want to go back, though, and talk for a little bit about hiring in that sports talk genre and come back to it. WMVP, the ESPN radio station, has 12 editorial employees. And in that group, there were 2 people of color and 1 woman. How do we get past that? How do we open up the doors and create a more inclusive environment?
Well, I think one of the things that they're going to have to do is they're going to have to look much deeper in sports. And what I mean by that is there are women who are knowledgeable about the various sports that we in this country have grown attached to, and they can tell those stories, and they need to be included in the mix. That hasn't happened in sports radio. It's been this sort of where jocks and wannabe jocks sort of live and cultivate and in a lot of ways grow their own. They aren't expanding in terms of bringing in people who are unlike them. And I think that's what needs to be happening.
And in sports television, I mean, I will not say that beauty and brains are mutually exclusive, but when it comes to hiring women sports correspondents, the first thing that most male executives do is look for the beauty, and then they hope the brains follows. If we could do something to be a little bit more open about finding the right talent and putting them on the air, then we'd all be better off.
Yeah, but, you know, I hate to say this, and this sounds bad no matter how I put it, but in radio, looks don't matter.
Right.
Well, that's
that
true.
Shouldn't be an
that's
issue.
True.
We're talking about
radio. But they
radio.
Were talking about a TV person.
True. They were talking about a TV person, but the fact that there's one woman involved in sports talk radio in a market like Chicago, where your ownership is CBS, where your ownership is ESPN and Disney, that's...
What's happening is that this issue is going to keep coming up and coming up, and as it gains traction, it's going to force them to do some things, because as you've talked about, things are going to change.
Okay, things are hopefully,
hopefully,
going to change. Yeah. I'd like to see that happen. There's another long-form piece of journalism that people have been talking a lot about, a four-day series from the Colorado Springs Gazette called Clearing the Haze. The paper teased the project with a Sunday front page banner that it was a perspective series being done by the Gazette, but on its website, it wasn't quite as transparent. It bills an exclusive look, quoting, that it would examine the health, social, regulatory, and financial issues associated with the world's boldest experiment with legal marijuana. It looks pretty slick. It uses that parallax design that readers became familiar with and got to know when the New York Times published its Snowfall Project a few years ago. But this piece didn't carry any bylines that showed that it was reported and produced primarily by two members of its editorial board and another former colleague of mine who is an advocacy journalist herself, Christine Tatum.
Well, you know, you could find it if you looked really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, perspective series, whatever that means, could have given you a clue.
Well, we would get it as journalist perspective. Right. Somebody else might think they may be thinking about doing a series.
under the headline in tiny little light gray type, you could have seen that it referenced it was an op-ed series.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the little sidebar, which had all kinds of other links and stuff that nobody ever reads, you could have found the names of the reporters. You could not have found that Christine Tatum was a journalist who was completely on the anti-pot legalization bandwagon, and her husband is a doctor who's also in that camp.
I just have one word for this, transparency.
Mm-hmm.
If the paper would have been transparent about what the series is about and the fact that they were anti-legalization, then they would
and
have
that
been
this
okay.
And that this was coming from the editorial board, which has a point of view as opposed to the newsroom, which traditionally doesn't.
Right, right.
And there's nothing wrong. I mean, there are people who are raising legitimate questions about the legalization of marijuana and its impact in Colorado. But the management also allegedly was telling reporting staff, don't say anything about this,
mm-hmm.
threatening them with the loss of their jobs if they said anything about it.
Well, we are pretty much out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can find more on the topics we talked about on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. Our thanks to RJS Travis McMillan and Maya Jackson for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Kristen Rowling is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.